At the beginning of the State of the Union address, in the middle of this kabuki dance of pageantry that they do there in the House chamber, we had Obama coming in after everybody else was seated. And as he walked towards the podium where he's going to give his State of the Union address, he comes across Tiny Tim Geithner. And he pauses to embrace Tiny Tim. He practically kissed him. It was a prolonged display of ostentatious affection coming from Obama to Geithner. This essentially vitiated, undermined, and canceled out anything serious that Obama tried to put in the State of the Union. There were a couple of useful points in the State of the Union address. The problem is, from the point of view of the current economic crisis and the need for economic populism as the precondition for economic and political survival, the embrace of Geithner in the full view of the entire regime, the House, the Senate, the Cabinet, the Supreme Court, all of them, and the TV cameras, the embrace of Geithner shortly before the speech began was essentially an act of political self-destruction. And this was the same day. We know that the Obama regime had spent the entire day shoring up support for the Wall Street puppet Bernanke, a Republican. Republican Ben Bernanke. So two Wall Street puppets, and let's not forget Larry Summers, the other principal Wall Street puppet. But these two, most viewed, Geithner, probably the most prominent cabinet officer, given the laid-back approach by Gates and the somewhat off-the-U.S. screen activities of Madame Clinton. Geithner is the number one guy, especially in this depression. So you get up there and you essentially give a kiss and a hug to Geithner after Geithner had been pounded all afternoon by the House Financial Services. Sorry, this was the House Committee on Oversight and Government Reform, the Kanjorski Committee in the House, had pounded Geithner all afternoon because of his corrupt, duplicitous, illegal, felonious double dealing in the AIG case. What did Obama understand? What did you get out of that Massachusetts vote, Obama? Remember, Mad Dog Bush the Younger in 2006, after the Republicans lost both houses of Congress, Mad Dog Bush, or at least his handlers, had the presence of mind to come out the next day and say, okay, I'm dumping Rumsfeld. I'm dumping the most unpopular, most odious, most hated member of the cabinet. And that was after losing both houses of Congress. Now, Obama by now should be able to see that he is on the way to a similar hecatomb. So the only thing for him to do is to come out and say, all right, Geithner, it's the afternoon of the State of the Union. It's the afternoon of Wednesday, the 27th. Geithner, you resign before I go to the Congress so I can announce that you've been dumped. And at that point, you'd be forcing the reactionary Republicans would have to applaud that because they don't like Geithner. But, of course, they're happy to let Geithner do the work for Wall Street. In other words, Geithner, the Wall Street puppet, does the things that otherwise the Republicans would have to do. So he takes them off the hook. So the Republicans would be there biting their tongues in rage, even as they had to applaud the ouster of Geithner. In order to they'd have to try to dupe their followers, but they'd really be enraged because they say, what? And then are we going to have to do this work and go out and take the flak for Wall Street in public? And, of course, then you'd have the Democratic liberal to left, liberal to New Deal, if there are any New Deal left, and there are a few. They would be sincerely applauding because of their great animus against Geithner. This sums up the present moment. I think, in a nutshell, the embrace of Geithner. Now, we can go through the State of the Union address. Much of it is of course, hogwash, but you have got this idea of building nuclear reactors. That is something to grab onto with both of your hands and your teeth and whatever else you've got, grab onto that nuclear reactor provision, because that, if properly handled, could lead to a significant stimulus, or better yet, recovery program. In particular, Obama says he wants $30 billion for jobs. Now, of course, $30 billion for jobs is a little bit of a joke after you've just given $700 billion in a bailout to Wall Street, which Obama organized for, even though the idea came from Bush the Younger and Paulson and Bernanke and Geithner when he was at the New York Fed. $30 billion jobs bill won't do anything much. But if you said we're going to have a $30 billion jobs bill and we're going to use that to start 100 nuclear reactors, you could get them started. You could at least do the startup cost and get them on their way for 6 months or a year. That would be a stimulus. That would bring on recovery. The trick here being, of course, that if you pour money into low-wage service jobs, if you think that you're going to have a recovery based on Starbucks, McDonald's, and retail sales, that is no recovery at all. Recovery starts with capital goods, modern, high technology, high energy intensity, high labor intensity, capital goods, but not the kind of stuff that would appeal to a Keynesian in the Democratic House caucus. But put together the opening to nuclear energy together with a $30 billion jobs bill, and you might have at least the opening wedge, the entry wedge of something serious. It's also interesting if you look at the Obama speech there, what he did not talk about. There's nothing about Copenhagen. Does it mean that he's turning away from some of the insanity on cap and trade? He then repeated, of course, he wants a climate change bill, and he took a lot of laughter. He was mocked and ridiculed essentially for saying the science may not be reliable, but the incentives are still a great thing. And for that, he was mocked, and deservedly so. The entire fake castle of lies, this monstrous edifice of duplicity and quackery and quackademicry around the global warming, the anthropogenic global warming, and these ideas, this is now collapsing. It's now also found that the reports of the shrinking of the Himalayan glaciers is based on some spurious report from some kind of partisan radical environmentalist journalist professor out there in India, and then this was bootlegged into this monstrous UN report. So after the East Anglia Climate Research Unit fakery emails, we've now got a second round of that same scandal. So the credibility of this is collapsing at the same time that we have these cold waves sweeping across the Northern Hemisphere. There is a small attempt to fight back. Washington Post this week had an article about how the cold weather and the snow is actually a feature of the of global warming. And the idea is this, that the reason you have so much snow is because the Great Lakes are not as covered with ice as they normally would be. And this means that when the storms come over, they can pick up moisture and you get lake effect snow. If it were colder, you'd have less lake effect snow. That's a nice try for that particular gambit. But, of course, the thing is the massive evidence across the board does not support this conclusion. So more on the Obama State of the Union and the deepening world economic depression in a minute.
This is Cascadia Public Radio.
D.C. So the State of the Union had nothing about Copenhagen, really, and nothing about Google China. Good. Time to back off on those, Obama. But it did have this idea about nuclear energy and some offshore drilling. And, of course, offshore drilling, why not? Of course. Makes a lot of sense. Don't dump that possibility. Instead, use it indeed as a means to gather support, because it's intelligible and popular, and you can use that to cut the ground out from under the green fanatics, the radical environmentalists, and those who are just against economic development. You can use it as a kind of a heuristic teaching tool. So anybody who's against that is obviously crazy in today's world, and indeed they are crazy. Now, at the same time, we've got Geithner being embraced by Obama at the beginning of this session. We've got Bernanke, but let's do a little bit more on Geithner first. The hearings on the 27th, we've got a pounding of Geithner. Congressman John Micah, the ranking member of the committee, Republican from Florida, says to Geithner, "You are either incompetent on the job or you are not doing your job, and you knew what was taking place and tried to conceal it. That's grounds for your removal. Fire him." Stephen Lynch, Democrat of Massachusetts, "It stinks to high heaven what happened here. I don't like the obfuscation. It makes me doubt your commitment to the American people." This guy also says, Lynch says, "Your commitment to Goldman Sachs trumps your commitment to the American people." Micah, "It stretched credulity. It doesn't make any sense. When you're being confirmed, a lot of controversy supported the fact you don't pay your taxes. You gave lame excuses then, and you're giving lame excuses now." Ken Jorski, the chairman, Democrat of Pennsylvania, "We have come to bury Caesar, not to praise him, and you're Caesar." Well, he's not quite Caesar. He's one of his minions. So he gets pounded, and he also gets pounded by some of these others. Jim Jordan, Republican of Ohio, "You said give $700 billion of taxpayer money." "I did not do that," Geithner said. "I'm saying the government," says Jordan. "Your government, your President Bush, Paulson, at the time." Geithner claimed that after arranging the AIG bailout as head of the New York Fed, he had had nothing to do with the efforts to conceal from the public the huge payments the government made to Wall Street giants such as Goldman Sachs that were AIG counterparties. But Geithner's claim and his insistence that he had nothing to do with AIG after being told he was going to be Obama's Secretary of the Treasury back in November of 08, this was undermined, in other words, perjury by Geithner, undermined by evidence the committee uncovered during a damning, including a damning March 2009 email written by Geithner. Elijah Cummings, Democrat of Maryland, says, "Remember, it's us Democrats. We are the ones who wanted this hearing. The American people are concerned that a lot is being done for Wall Street, but not enough being done for Main Street. Do you understand that?" Marcy Kaptur, a Democrat of Ohio, one of the better ones, "You nationalized AIG and let the bank creditors off the hook." Lynn Westmoreland, Republican of Georgia, "It was obvious that the AIG deal is a bad deal for taxpayers." And that is very interesting. That would have been the time. Smart politician, somebody like Franklin D. Roosevelt, who did this several times, would say, "Okay, Geithner, that's it. You're finished." Now, you can keep Geithner a little bit longer as a kind of lightning rod to absorb criticism that would otherwise be directed at you. And I think that's the only thing that's holding Geithner up, is that he's taken the flack that otherwise would go directly to Barkey. So Barkey wants to keep him for that reason. But still, it's time to dump Geithner. Geithner must go. During this past week, my website, tarpley.net, pioneered a campaign to stop Bernanke. We had an article. It became clear last Sunday that the Bernanke nomination was in real trouble, because you had Dorgan, Feingold, and Boxer among the Democrats, along with Sanders, independent, and Bunning, and quite a few others, saying that they could not support Bernanke. So we organized essentially a letter writing campaign. So that was posted on Sunday night. There was a letter on my website, which is still there, which you can send to your senator, demanding that Bernanke be defeated and that they find somebody who would be the right person to superintend the transition of the Federal Reserve to a Bureau of the Treasury. In other words, to run the Federal Reserve during the process of nationalization. Yes. The politicization of the Federal Reserve. That's what you want. Those economic questions. Interest rate questions are not technical questions. They're not technical questions of economics. They are the most political questions of them all. You cannot take that entire area of politics, the whole area of economic policy, or large parts of it, ripped out of the hands of the legal constitutional government. You put it into the hands of these unelected, faceless cliques of unaccountable bankers, predatory bankers, rip-off artists, asset strippers, and the rest of them. They hide behind a facade of academic economics, which is absolutely insane. It's the most corrupt and discredited and bankrupt of all the disciplines. And economics basically says whatever the reactionary power structure wants at any given moment over decades. Time to nationalize the Fed. So keep that up. But also Bernanke. Now let's just look at Helicopter Ben. Now you can see there. It became clear on the weekend that Helicopter Ben was in real trouble. So that's the time when you see that kind of an opportunity, it's time to mobilize. Now, the vote was yesterday. Unfortunately, Helicopter Ben did get through. On the cloture vote, it was 77 to 23. 77 to 23. They needed 60 votes on that, thanks to Bunning, Republican of Kentucky, and Bernie Sanders, Independent Socialist of Vermont. Showing that there is a bipartisan opposition to Helicopter Ben. 77 to 23 on the cloture. And then on the actual vote, where he only needed 50, it was 70 to 30. Now, this is the worst result for any Fed chairman in history. Nobody has ever had that many votes against him. Bernanke is now politically wounded. He comes in under a cloud. If he had any honor, he'd resign. He'd say, that's not enough for me. I'm sorry. 30 negative votes is too much for me. I can't do my job. Bernanke, if you're so concerned about having it politicized, you should resign because your presence is making it politicized, if that's the consideration. Of course, let me hasten to underline, I, Tarpley, am in favor of the politicization. I want it politicized totally. I want it to the point where the money supply, the interest rates, and the approved categories of lending are politicized to the point where the House votes them, the Senate votes them, and the President has to sign them, all in the light of day. The last time around, Volcker got 16 negative votes. So Bernanke got almost twice as many as Volcker in the mid-1980s. Back in a minute on World Crisis Radio.
This is the GCN Radio Network.
Welcome back to World Crisis Radio. Webster Tarpley here in Washington, D.C. So the Obama State of the Union address had three things in it. Grab these three, actually four, and we can use them as the wedge end of an actual recovery policy. And those are nuclear reactors, offshore drilling, high-speed rail, and a $30 billion jobs bill, which has to be at least 10 times that to begin with. But get everything going, and then you'll have unstoppable political momentum, because once these building projects have started and you've created a couple of million jobs, nobody is going to listen to ideological arguments from Malthusians on the left or from monetarists on the right to stop them. And this will begin to take off. Now, the question with Bernanke, it's obvious that the Obama White House invested a lot of political capital in supporting Bernanke, and it just shows how impossible this is, right? You cannot have a government run by Rahm Emanuel and Larry Summers who are telling Obama, yeah, go out and be a populist with these small-bore anti-Wall Street initiatives, some of which have a little bit of merit, right? But they're just little laundry list items, small-bore, symbolic stuff, Dick Morris kind of stuff, Dick Morris in reverse, right? Things that, look economic populist, but they don't amount to a whole lot. You can't make that coexist with support for Geithner and support for Bernanke, and then having Larry Summers running the economic policy from behind the scenes. Let's take a look at this vote. As I said, the cloture vote was 77-23. That was Thursday. Yesterday, as we're recording, at about 3:45 p.m. And then by 4 o'clock, just as the markets were closing, the actual vote occurred. And on this one, it was 70-30. Now, I would just let's just take a minute, and it may seem not a good use of time, but I think it is. I want you to know who voted against Bernanke. And the point of this is, if you don't hear your senator on this thing, it means that you've got to get rid of them. You've got to get them out. This is the minimum precondition for political survival. And it's here are the ones who are against Bernanke. Against Bernanke were Begich, Democrat of Alaska, Boxer, Democrat of California, Brownback, Republican of Kansas, Bunning, Republican of Kentucky, did yeoman service, Cantwell, Democrat of Washington, radicalizing that Cantwell, Cornyn, Republican of Texas, Crapo, Republican of Idaho, DeMint, Republican of South Carolina, an honest reactionary doing God's work, we might say, Dorgan, Democrat of North Dakota, duplicitous because he voted in favor of cloture. Dorgan was for Bernanke before he was against him. Ensign, Republican of Nevada. Feingold, Democrat of Wisconsin. Franken, Democrat of Minnesota. That's no joke. Grassley, Republican of Iowa. Harkin, Democrat of Iowa. Go Iowa. Hutchinson, Republican of Texas. That gives Texas a perfect record. Imhoff, Republican of Oklahoma. Kaufman, Democrat of Delaware. Lemieux, Republican of Florida. McCain, Republican of Arizona. There's a big vote. Merkley, Democrat of Oregon. Oregon looks good. Risch, Republican of Idaho. Idaho looks good. Roberts, Republican of Kansas. Sanders, Independent Socialist of Vermont. Sessions, Republican of Alabama. Shelby, Republican of Alabama. Go Alabama. Specter, Democrat of Pennsylvania. Thune, Republican of South Dakota. Vitter, Republican of Louisiana. White House, a surprise, a blue blood, Democrat of Rhode Island, probably afraid of getting booted out after this Scott Brown stuff. Wicker, Republican of Mississippi. Now, rather than look at that in terms of just Republicans, Democrats, go back and get one of those maps of the populist party. Go back to the William Jennings Bryan or similar, that was, of course, a Democrat, but tinged with populism. And you'll see the idea that Western and Southern states, Midwestern states, rural states are increasingly angry with the Fed. And the that list will repay some analysis in future weeks and months. But the idea here is that there is now a building resentment and resistance to the Federal Reserve. And again, the answer is sure, audit it on the way, but you got to regard the audit as a tool to get it nationalized. We had a couple of interesting speeches. Cantwell and Dorgan both felt compelled to come out, both Democrats, coming out against Bernanke, but then they wanted to talk about it. Cantwell of Oregon, this is a surprise because this is a person from whom one hears rather little. She gets out there and gives a big speech about the dark market of derivatives, the dark pools. She says that Bernanke is responsible for the deregulation of derivatives. Cantwell wants to regulate derivatives, and she talks about making certain kinds of derivatives or certain derivatives transactions a federal crime with jail time. This is interesting. Cantwell, an index maybe not so much of individual merit but of general radicalization. She talks about Vancouver Iron and Steel Works. They don't market derivatives in dark pools, but then when the local bank went under and was seized by the FDIC, the credit line needed by Vancouver Iron and Steel, now this is tangible physical production, was pulled. No more credit for them. They go under. So she, Cantwell, basically says, I'm supporting Bernanke and Tim Geithner because they've got to support government regulation of derivatives. Well, that, of course, is the pathetic fallacy in a nutshell. But who's going to be preventing another derivatives bubble? She wants Glass-Steagall, no subsidies for the dark market of derivatives. Volcker rule is not enough. You've got to have full Glass-Steagall. And we've had two decades of derivatives leading to a big financial bubble. So far, Cantwell, one of the more radical speeches, I mean, that gets you to the level of DeFazio, Kaptur, Sherman, and some of these other House Democrats. So this is going in an interesting direction. Dorgan attacks synthetic derivatives. He says the synthetic derivatives are simply a craps table. They're just a gambling casino in the lobby of Goldman Sachs. Dorgan stresses, Ben Bernanke was part of the Bush team. He's an integral part of the Bush the Younger economic team. He's talking about, Dorgan talks about foreclosures. And he says that he, Dorgan, and I believe Grassley, and eight other senators sent Bernanke a letter saying, Dear Ben Bernanke, you have opened up the Federal Reserve for the first time in history to make loans to investment banks, not just, you know, commercial banks, Federal Reserve member banks, but now investment banks, which means brokerages, right? It means hedge funds in today's world. So let's call them hedge funds. Dorgan and these basically 10 senators, a considerable group, write to Ben Bernanke saying, we demand to know the money that you have lent to these hedge funds, Goldman Sachs, Morgan Stanley, and the rest of them. And Bernanke writes back, I am not going to tell you. And that's in the middle of a confirmation hearing. What arrogance, what impudence. Too bad Moore didn't join in voting against him, but at least it is the most politicized vote of a Fed chief in United States history. And again, it's twice as many votes as Volcker had to face against him. And remember that Volcker had brought the prime rate up to 22-23%, meaning that interest rates for the average person went much higher. So we've got the commentators on television that afternoon lamenting that it was the most politicized Fed vote ever, that this was unthinkable, would have been unthinkable a few years ago. Both Greenspan and Volcker essentially got a free pass for their second term. Volcker, 16 negative votes. Greenspan, almost no negative votes. And in some cases, this was just a voice vote with no recorded vote. Again, if the Democrats had voted against Bernanke, they would have forced many Republicans to vote for him to show the true colors of the Republicans. But the corruption of the Democrats by Wall Street is overwhelming. We'll be back in just a minute with our Iceland report.
America's number one source for independent talk radio for over a decade. We are the GCN Radio Network.
Welcome back to World Crisis Radio. So the vote against Bernanke was significant, a substantial vote against Bernanke, and a couple of commentators freaking out that the Sanders and Bunning holds to stop the Bernanke nomination from going through might have influenced monetary policy. What? Two elected senators influencing an unelected, unappointed, unaccountable Bernanke there at the Fed, that's an outrage in the opinion of many commentators on CNBC. Now, let's shift gears and let's get into the area of international economics. Big international moves against the International Monetary Fund and against, in particular, the City of London and its Dutch satellites, the Anglo-Dutch banking cabal with significant indeed, preponderant influence over the International Monetary Fund. And let's not forget our friends over at the European Commission, where the tinged with fascism Barroso has just started another regime with the chosen commissioner. So for this, we go to Reykjavik, Iceland, and our correspondent in the midst of the campaign, the referendum campaign, should Iceland sign itself into national suicide by attempting to pay $6 billion or thereabouts to the British and the Dutch as demanded by the IMF and the European Commission. So here is now Thorarin Einarsson in the heart of Reykjavik.
Yes, hello.
Can you hear me, Thorarin?
Yes, I can.
Wonderful. So we know then that the referendum there is March 6th. So what's going on? What does it look like on the streets there in Reykjavik? Any big rallies or other developments to keep us up to date with?
Yeah, and I can say there are still big rallies, and there is. It's possible that it will be postponed because of there is a report too about the financial crash that Icelanders have been waiting for over a year, and it's not finished. And of course, it should be published before the referendum. So that's also debated if the referendum should be postponed.
Whose report is that? What report?
It's about the financial crash. There was a parliamentary committee that over a year ago they started to work on this report. So this is a report that would say pretty much, you know, who is the guilty parties. So there are a lot of expectations.
So it's a report. It's a report from the political parties represented in the Icelandic parliament.
Yeah, kind of.
Okay.
So, you know, it's an investigative committee.
And what's the argument about delaying the vote in order to get this?
It's nothing special, actually. It's just saying that people will be more informed to take a better decision in the referendum, having this report published.
Now, just as when you say this report, I want to just remind our listeners, some of them may have heard of Eva Jolie, who is, of course, this very distinguished Norwegian-French investigating judge, right? And she's been brought in to do what amounts to a criminal investigation, or at least an investigation that may have criminal consequences with real indictments. I take it that is not the report that we're dealing with.
No, I mean, she is an advisor to a special prosecutor, so that's something different. But, of course, it's related, and Eva Jolie has been doing a very good job here.
Okay. Now, in terms of the arguments flying back and forth, maybe you could give us a sampling. Have there been any, unusually interesting editorials or op-eds, right, opinion editorials in the papers for and against this kind of a paying, right? And I also wonder, now that Greece seems to be on the verge of bankruptcy, and the euro is going down like a rock, and even the dollar, which is a very sickly currency, seems to be getting at least a new lease on life temporarily. Are there people who are saying that, you know, the IMF system just doesn't work, and look at these examples in other countries, or maybe Haiti? Has anybody brought that up?
I think people are getting more aware, and it's getting more obvious, the real role of the IMF. And, of course, Icelanders are starting to figure that out. And also a little bit more, after Haiti, when Haiti was in the news and their debts. And we see also that, the bloody history of IMF everywhere popping up. So it's only helping people to realize the real nature of these kind of institutions.
Now, I know you were looking to try to do an interview with an IMF official. Have we got?
No, I didn't. He promised several times that he would talk to us, and then he kind of disappeared. And he has given interviews, but not real, information. He is just a spokesman that gives dry formal answers. So he cannot give anything of value.
But I'm wondering if the International Monetary Fund has sent any officials there to try to interfere, right, to try to come to Iceland and give press conferences or talk to groups, give lectures, saying, oh, you know, in the world of globalization, you've got to pay, and debt is sacrosanct, and your national interests mean nothing. Anything like that. Or
no,
from the European
very limited. It's more like just letters. Occasional press conferences, but, you know, nothing big and nothing important. I would like to mention one thing, that though, the finance minister just went, just had a meeting now with the minister of finance in Netherlands, and the Netherlands, the government is saying that Iceland has to pay. They have to pay in full the loan in question. So that's a very strong demand.
The Dutch repeat their demand of blackmail and extortion that Iceland has to pay to the last Icelander, and Iceland be damned, and debt is sacrosanct. And
he's saying that you have to pay in full the amount, but what is negotiable is maybe the interest and the time.
That's big of them. And we have to remind our listeners, there is absolutely no legal basis for this. In other words, there's no signed contract. It's not even like an IMF loan where they make you sign at gunpoint. Iceland never signed for this, right? These were bank branches that were put into Holland and Britain, and the Dutch and the British knew better than anyone else that these were unsound, fly-by-night, unreliable that would banks that might, you know, blow up in the first gust of wind, but they nevertheless welcomed them in the name of globalization and deregulation and the free flow of capital and financial flim-flam across borders, right?
Yeah, well, of course, we really need to get this, you know, information out, and what we are doing now, the No Group, we are preparing to put up a website, should be ready in a few days, and we are going to have the all important documents and also try to make short, clear presentations of the arguments against the bill. But still, it can be also hard. I can practice on my father. I haven't still be able to convince my father.
Okay. All right, that's our time is up. We'll see you next week, and long live the rejection front there, the No Group in Iceland. And we'll see you next week.
Yep. Okay.